struggle for peace and justice. He'll make you smile with funny songs about peace, hypocrisy, greedy corporations, and intolerance. The Houston Peace and Justice Center is bringing him to town Saturday, March 29th, to a fundraiser for Peace Camp Houston. The show starts at 7 p.m. at the Live Oak Friends Meeting House, 1318 West 26th Street in Houston. An optional potluck dinner will be just before the show at 6 p.m. for anyone wanting to share food and drinks and company. For details and to get discount tickets, go to the Houston Peace and Justice Center website at hpjc.org. This is KPFT, Houston.
Welcome to another edition of the Progressive Forum. The Progressive Forum covers issues such as human rights, the environment, politics, and peace and justice, in addition to presenting news, commentary, and a weekly calendar of events.
This is KPFT 9.1 Pacifica Radio in Houston. The program's a Progressive Forum. I'm Wally James. Welcome to the show. Coming up on tonight's program, we're going to have an interview with James A. Mitchell. He is the author of the new book, The Walrus and the Elephant, John Lennon's Year of Revolution. And then also, we're going to have a talk coming up after that. It's going to be David Barsanian. He has a new book with Noam Chomsky. And he was in Houston recently on February 26th and gave a talk on that. And I recorded that and we'll be playing that. So stick around and have all that. Before we get things started, though, we're going to go to This Week in History and our our commentary by Matt Rothschild. But we don't have those anymore. He doesn't do that. Okay, up next is history. This Week in History, March 16th, 1827, the first black newspaper in the United States, the Freedom Journal, is published. On March 20th, 1852, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin is published. On March 20th, 1896, the U.S. Marines invade Nicaragua. March 21st, 1919, Puerto Ricans are killed during a demonstration for independence. On March 17th, 1960, President Dwight Eisenhower authorizes secret training of Cuban exiles for an invasion of Cuba. On March 18th, 1963, the U.S. Supreme Court rules that states must provide legal counsel for the indigent. On March 19th, 1964, 49 people are arrested during a protest against Chase Manhattan Bank for making loans to South Africa. On March 21st, 1965, Martin Luther King leads the Selma, Alabama march. And on March 16th, 1968, about 500 unarmed Vietnamese are killed by U.S. troops in the My Lai massacre. That's This Week in History. This information comes from the calendar, The Hidden History of the United States.
Thank you.
This is the Progressive Forum on KPFT in Houston. Our guest tonight is James A. Mitchell. He is author of the new book, The Walrus and the Elephants, John Lennon's Year of Revolution. Some of his other, in fact, the other three books I have by him are But for the Grace of, But for the Grace, Profiles in Peace from a Nation at War, It Was All Right, Mitch Ryder's Life in Music, and Applegate, Freedom of Press in a Small Town. Jim, welcome to the Progressive Forum.
Thank you much for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, let's start out. This book goes into a history of Lennon that I think a lot of people aren't familiar with. Can you talk a little bit about what was happening with him back in 1972 and his desire to shake things up and why he wanted to do more than just, you know, sing songs about, you know, give peace a chance?
Sure. I mean, really the story began not long after John and Yoko in 1971, about middle of the year, had moved to America. For a number of reasons, part of which was Yoko was trying to reconnect with her daughter, who was with her former husband. Even before leaving England throughout 71 and late 70, Lennon had been giving rather extensive interviews and saying he wanted to do more. He wanted to be a part of the movement, that these things, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, even the early strains of feminism. You know, he basically was questioning what it meant to be a celebrity, and coming from the perspective of having just left, you know, the most successful entertainment act probably in history in terms of both commercial success and, even more importantly, influence. And so when he hit America, he was very eager, very interested in getting involved in a more direct way, as you say, more than just necessarily singing songs, which he wanted to do, but also to use his celebrity as a forum for raising these many, many issues that were going on.
How did he get connected to Jerry Rubin, one of the Chicago Seven?
Well, Rubin and his partner, Abby Hoffman, certainly were, you know, brazen enough. They were among the many, shall we say, who courted John and Yoko. It's interesting to know, you know, John and Yoko sold an estate in England, Tittenhurst, when they moved to America, and for the first year thereabouts, they lived in a really modest, unassuming little apartment in the West Village, not even like a doorman building, you know, just in there walking around Washington Square Park. And it was Rubin apparently contacted Apple, and Yoko, from what I've read, responded, and they agreed to meet in the Village, and, you know, Lennon took an open mind into his meetings with any of the new leaders of the New Left, whether it was the Chicago Seven or the leaders of the Black Panther Party, the leaders of the women's movement, etc. And Rubin was definitely one.
What about John Sinclair? Can you tell us about him and how Lennon came to be a part of that concert?
And that, too, really was through Rubin. Rubin was very connected with the different movements. And Abby Hoffman actually had tried to rally the John Sinclair cause. Sinclair was sentenced in 1969 for possession of two joints, and he was given a 10-year sentence. At the time, even simple possession of marijuana was a felony. So he'd sat there for 2 years. Abby Hoffman tried to talk about it at Woodstock, in fact. And then in 71, the key thing that happened, John Sinclair, for those who don't know, was a radical poet, very much active in Detroit, Ann Arbor, which were very political scenes at the time. The SDS had a lot of its origins in Ann Arbor as well. And so Sinclair's imprisonment became a rallying point. In 1971, a lot of states were considering revising pot laws, largely because Nixon had lowered the voting age to 18. And Michigan was one of those states. So sort of a timing came together, and with this new attention, John Sinclair supporters were planning some kind of rally on his behalf. Rubin and council promoter Peter Andrews from Michigan asked, and John and Yoko said, sure, and they flew out for a December 10th concert in Ann Arbor, let him perform four songs. And Sinclair was released 2 days later. And even though there were some other mechanisms in place, the bandwagon, Lennon's appearance, drew the support of people like the Ann Arbor mayor, the Lansing City Council. So suddenly it was, you know, the cause. And Lennon got all the credit, or in the eyes of the Nixon administration, the blame.
Okay, talk about that, about the Nixon administration and how they saw Lennon as a threat.
Well, very much it was sparked by Sinclair's release. Now, when Sinclair was released so immediately, Lennon, Rubin, Hoffman, and in particular a planner named Rennie Davis, one of the Chicago Seven, they figured, okay, let's take the act on the road. And heading into the 1972 presidential election campaigns, take a kind of anti-war campaign on the road, stopping at the key cities along the way. And so when those plans became known, coupled with the Sinclair release, it really started in February 72 with a memo from U.S. Senator Strom Thurmond. To, among other people, you know, Nixon's inner staff, with attached FBI documents and reports on the concert and what they were planning. And it was decided it would be a good, and I quote, good counter strategy to have this man deported. And it really wasn't because they didn't want to hear his anti-war views. It was very much he might, you know, rally too many young voters against Nixon. And Nixon wielded, as history shows, the FBI and his administration as a political tool. According to Dick Cavett's book, H.R. Haldeman was heard on one of the Oval Office recordings saying of Lennon, quote, this man could sway an election. So they seriously thought he had that kind of influence. And coming right off the Beatles, maybe they had reason to believe that. Would he have changed the election outcome? It's hard to say.
You mentioned the FBI. How about J. Edgar Hoover? What was his position on this?
Well, I mean, Hoover had been, you know, famously quoted as saying he had told Nixon, my job is to help you get reelected, which, you know, is not in the job description of law enforcement. And very much these memos went on with Hoover's blessing, as did many of the other politically motivated crimes of the Nixon administration. And it is funny that, Hoover died in June of that year. And up until then, from about February until June, Lennon had been under pretty much constant surveillance. And they were even leaning towards, you know, try to set up a drug bust as a reason to deport him. But after Hoover's death, some of the intensity dialed down. And in fact, his replacement reminded agents that a matter like that is not really an FBI matter. So the fact that they had been violating the law was noted by his successors.
And they were tapping his phone, following him around. Is that what they were doing?
Absolutely. Mm. Compiling it all. And the FBI had informants that had, so to speak, infiltrated. You know, there was a woman taking notes at one of the meetings at several of the meetings in Ruben's apartment. There were people taking notes at the meetings that planned the concert tour. I guess the problem was they didn't trust anyone over 30, but they automatically trusted everyone under 30. You know, and if the ones that did, whether they were informants for their own motivations, no, they knew what was going on.
Well, the name of your book is The Walrus and the Elephants. Tell us about the Elephants, Elephants Memory. This is a band that John Lennon wound up getting with his backup band, as his backup band. I understand there was he wasn't too happy with some of the backup he had had up to that point.
Well, at least what he'd found in New York, or initially in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true, what he was looking for was a band, and Elephant's Memory may be the most overlooked footnote in rock history. And it really was more than just a fleeting encounter, and it was my pleasure to interview three of the bandsmen who, you know, they spent a lot of time with John and Yoko and had some great memories and even some funny stories throughout the book. Elephant's Memory were definitely, you know, on the cutting edge counterculture type bands. They were friends with the two founders, were friends with the Hells Angels and Jerry Rubin, who was the one who played for John a tape the band had made at a radio station. They were pretty good. Even before the new members, they had two songs on the soundtrack of Midnight Cowboy. You know, very much out there, gritty New York. Lennon, when he first got there was a street musician, David Peel, who, you know, brought his guitar players along, but they just weren't that good. So Ruben introduced the Elephants to John and Yoko, and after playing all night, jamming to old songs, you know, they won the gig, and they were damn good. When I say it was more than a fleeting involvement, in probably December of 71, the Elephants signed on retainer, and over the next nearly year, a little over a year, actually, with John and Yoko, they made three albums, the first being Lennon's Sometime in New York City. Again, an overlooked album, his most openly political. But they also made an album of their own, and they backed Yoko and John on a Yoko Ono album. So, you know, three album output plus through this period, which is featured in the book quite heavily. They run a lot of TV shows, A Week on the Mike Douglas Show, Dick Cavett. They did the Jerry Lewis Telephone. And the Elephants had the distinction of being, you know, his support at the only full-length solo John Lennon concert. Up until August 1972, he had done sporadic two or three song sets, you know, here or there, but never a full-out concert in that, which was captured on John Lennon Live in New York City. And the first and only. It was supposed to be the beginning of a world tour, but unfortunately the green card issues made that impossible.
I want to talk about that some more, but let's back up a little bit and talk about the Mike Douglas Show. I was totally unaware of this. You had Lennon and Yoko. They were co-hosting. I mean, they weren't just guests. They were co-hosting the show with Mike Douglas, and they got to pick a lot of the guests that came on. And they had Ralph Nader on. I've gone on YouTube, and you can see John Lennon interviewing Ralph Nader. And it's interesting. A lot of the stuff Nader was saying back then is similar to what he's saying now, but it was really an amazing thing that the people he was able to bring on TV that nobody else was doing.
Oh, absolutely. Mike Douglas, you know, for those who may not remember him, Afternoon, and by his own admission, kind of a light talk show, you know, aimed at the housewives, but very successful. He was on the air for, what, 30 years or something. And he said the John and Yoko week was the most memorable. They had never given that much freedom to the week's guest host to pick the guests that would come on. And sure, he had Ralph Nader. He had a man named Joe Blatchford, the head of the Peace Corps. He brought on Bobby Seale, one of the co-founders of the Black Panther Party. He brought a civil rights attorney on. And he also brought on Jerry Rubin, who Mike Douglas did not want to have on the air. And it was a pretty fascinating conversation. But, yeah, you look at that week's worth of shows, and what a time capsule of American politics. And again, here's Lennon wanting to use his celebrity for something more than just talk about his hit record or talk about, you know, the Beatles all week or whatever. But, you know, he's sitting there interviewing Ralph Nader. I'm bringing these conversations up.
And one of the things he's talking to Nader about is trying to get out the youth vote, and this book that Nader had about, you know, organizing, about young people organizing.
Absolutely. It was be a part of the movement, get out there, get the people who were experts on it to talk, and, you know, try to raise some consciousness. And he wasn't saying, you know, get the youth vote out against Nixon, just get the youth vote out, get people active.
Yeah. Also, a highlight was him playing with Chuck Berry. Again, you can see that on YouTube, and that's just, you can tell that Lennon's just really enjoying that a lot.
Well, he sure put a happy face on on one of the ones, apparently, Chuck Berry, and my friends in the Elephants told me these stories, that Chuck could be a very stubborn man, and they rehearsed Johnny B. Goode in a particular key, you know, through the day, and mm-hmm. then when they started, Barry played it in a different key, and everybody had to switch. But no, Lennon did say it was the highlight of the week. And if you find it on YouTube, Lennon and Chuck Berry doing Memphis, you know, that belongs in a special place in the Rock Hall of Fame. Great moments.
Definitely. Yeah, I would encourage people to check that out. But your book, you know, you talk about so much more. It is amazing to me that, you know, Lennon was really putting himself out there. You know, you have the John Sinclair concert. You have going on these talk shows, talking to Dick Cavett and others. And he's really, you know, trying to get, you know, make a difference. He's trying to get his views out there and inform people.
Absolutely. He, you know, as I said, using celebrity different. And what's important to note, and one of the things I enjoyed with the book, was having all these contemporary conversations with people who, at least, and looking back at the clips, yeah, it's not to say, you know, Lennon wasn't risking his career or his wealth. I mean, he had hit the top of the mountain. But a lot of people thought he was really weird back then. Even Beatles fans had a hard time. You know, what was he doing? And, you know, today's the anniversary of John Yoko's honeymoon that they turned into a peace campaign. And a lot of people had thought, oh, you know, they lost their minds. And what was interesting, that you look back on it, and Lennon explained it to the New York Times. He said, you know, you're the ones putting me on the front page of the paper. Everywhere we go, there's photographers, so why not have the word peace, you know, get on the front page? He took out the billboard. War is over if you want it. And as John Sinclair said, and by the way, the billboard came out a year before he had not written the song yet, the Christmas song, you know, that used that as the chant. And as John Sinclair said, nobody was doing anything like that. I mean, who took out a billboard for peace? You know, you promoted your new single or your new movie or whatever, but not an idea that was unheard of. And yet, look at the blueprint that people like Angelina Jolie and George Clooney have done the same thing. Bob Geldof used the press, the same blueprint for Live Aid. You know, you're going to follow us. Let's go show the issue. Let's take the, you know, have the press follow us and show issues, raise consciousness, get more aware. Lenin was doing all that.
Yeah, in a time when nobody expected it. It was really amazing that he was able to do that. But again, it's his celebrity. He was such a big name that they were willing to put him on the air in spite of that.
Nobody else could have gotten away with getting Jerry Rubin on network television. Certainly not something like an afternoon talk show aimed at housewives. And it just showed the cloud. He was probably the only one. You know, and again, his influence. Neil Young wrote a song calling Nixon out by name over Kent State, but they never touched his passport. Neil Young is Canadian. Mm-hmm. They never tried to deport him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just Lenin. George Harrison campaigned for peace, kind of, you know, and also promoted Eastern religions. But they didn't try to deport him, and he was in America. You know, Lenin had the clout.
Definitely. Well, let's get back to the deportation that he was facing during all this time and this fight. I mean, he gets a notice from the government that he's got like 15 days to get out of the country. And what happens? What is he able to do to stay in the country all that time?
Well, the one thing, two things that Hoover and Nixon kind of forgot was, you know, Lenin didn't do what he was told to do, just by habit, you know, just by nature. You know, the only peer pressure he ever succumbed to was the other Beatles, and then only barely. So when they sent him the order, you know, no, he wasn't just going to get out. And the other thing they forgot, he was incredibly wealthy. They got the best immigration lawyer, or at least one of the best firms, and the attorney, Leon Wiles, and he fought back. He wasn't just going to go, even knowing over the months. So all this is going on, that's right. He was appearing on TV. He was appearing publicly at rallies in New York, in New York City in 72. There was probably a rally a week for some kind of cause, and Lenin was at a lot of them. While every other day going to INS hearings or, you know, meeting with the attorneys and doing the recording work and looking for Yoko's daughter, et cetera.
Talk about that, about Yoko's daughter and how that played a part in them trying to stay in the country because she wanted to reunite with her daughter.
Right, and I can't claim to be an expert on the full background of Yoko's ex-husband, Tony Cox, had custody of their daughter, Kyoko. And, you know, whether he was contentious all along or if he just saw dollar signs when an ex-Beatle came into the picture, who knows? He was being difficult and moving the girl around from place to place. And that was a big part of the motivation of John and Yoko to move to America. So it became part of the case as well because, you know, okay, if you deport Lenin, then you're forcing Yoko to choose between her daughter and her husband. And over what? You know, the only reason they had was he had a 3-year-old misdemeanor hash conviction in England. But basically, he played the system. And, you know, it's just, it was one thing for them to order, okay, go out, but the system, the bureaucracy, if you just file appeals and delays and motions, that kind of hung there in limbo and did hang there for about 3 years.
But this was a stress on him the whole time. I mean, he's wanting to do tours. He's wanting to really get out there. I mean, he wants to make a difference with the movement, but also he just wanted to play before people. And he has all this weighing on him all the time. Can you talk just a little bit about, you know, how that was affecting Lenin?
Well, it certainly built up, and I, in my opinion, you know, after going through it and seeing just how much was pressure was on it. On top of all that, you also had the legal dissolution of the Beatles going on at the same time. They were still, you know, working out exactly what it meant legally and royalties and this and all of that. It did build on him after a while. He was trying. He just sincerely tried. And what he got was a lot of trouble for his effort. He was asked to weigh in on issues, and he released an album filled with political songs. The critics blasted the record. You know, and at the time, with TV, you know, mostly it was because of how much stage time or record time he was giving to Yoko. And she was very disliked. She was very polarizing among Beatle fans. You know, the cliche that she broke up the Beatles, which is not true, stayed with her for a long time. So it built, and, you know, I think it all came to a head the night of Nixon's reelection, the overwhelming reelection. You know, the leaders were still looking at Lennon saying, you know, you got to do it. You got to rally it back up. And he just about had enough. It wasn't too long after that that he went to L.A. for his so-called lost weekend. He couldn't tour. He couldn't perform for money. Things were getting tense. He'd been with Yoko 24/7 for well over 3 years at that point. And he went and blew off some steam. But what's interesting, at the end of the so-called lost weekend period, he had enough, and as the end of the book points out, he and his attorney, Leon Wilds, they took the government to court. They filed a lawsuit of selective prosecution in order to get his green card, and he won.
And it's amazing that, you know, he went through so much, and, you know, and survived it and was able to finally, you know, be able to legally stay in the country. But I want to back up just a second. There was something I read in your book about how, you know, Lennon supported feminism, civil rights for blacks and Native Americans. And this was something that the FBI considered a subversion.
Subversions, yep. The terminology, when you look back at the language of things and what people were saying, you know, don't forget the guy who led this or first pointed it out, Strom Thurmond, was a known segregationist. And even as late as 71, 72, you know, this isn't long after George Wallace, you know, campaigned on that. And yeah, according to the FBI documents, the fact that he supported those things you mentioned, the FBI agent described as subversions. Amazing.
It really is.
You know, the then and now contrast is interesting in the book. One of the other gentlemen I spoke with, Ron Dellums, was a U.S. congressman, all told 28 years. And in 1971, he was part of the Congressional Black Caucus, which was only 13 members, combined House and Senate. Sad little minorities. And there were only 15 women at the time.
Yes. And Lennon was very supportive of feminism, something that I think, you know, a lot of people, you know, saw the Beatles with all the, you know, the young girls chasing him and everything. And I think it was a surprise at what a strong feminist he was.
And that was an evolution, and absolutely the credit to that goes to Yoko. He just opened his mind to, you know, don't forget, Lennon and the Beatles and all of their generation, you know, were coming off the post-war mentality of the 50s that they grew up in, and the roles of men and women were very rigidly defined. In particular, in a port town like Liverpool, the whole background there. So yeah, it took him a while to shake it off and learn, but he was ahead of it, and very much through Yoko, just realized, you know, as somebody he'd said, you know, he was curious how people in the movement treated women, because even a lot of enlightened men in terms of civil rights and in terms of anti-war, you know, Gloria Steinem said women who volunteered at anti-war rallies were told to make the coffee and do the mimeographing. You know, they weren't there for their opinions or minds,
Yeah.
And that really gave birth, to, according to Ms. Steinem, that gave birth to the women's movement, that they weren't given an equal role or an active role in these critical issues that they wanted to join, the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement. So, yeah, another case where Lenin was just way ahead of it. And as the end of the book, the timing of it, the day he got his green card was the day his son was born. And he basically walked away from show business for 5 years and was a very dedicated father. And that wasn't all that cool back in 75. I mean, he gave up being a millionaire rock star. But now you look at it and it's not only cool, it's admirable.
Yeah, I think that surprised a lot of people when he did that. But we just got a few minutes left, about 3 minutes, and I know there's a lot that we haven't been able to get to, so I'd like to give this time to talk about whatever you'd like to.
Just, you know what, I appreciate it. Yeah, there's a lot more to it. There was a lot more to the story than I thought going in, and one of the reasons that it attracted me was, you know, the big full Lenin biographies have been written, and been written very well. But this particular story seemed to, it hadn't gotten as much exposure, and neither really had the members of Elephant's Memory. And again, they're considered a footnote, but considering Lenin's solo career was relatively short, you know, they were really his only full-time band. You know, the rest of the albums, he just used assorted studio players. And they'd never had a chance to tell these stories. What I liked is the fact that over the years, they never came out with, you know, scandalous stories. They never tried to cash in by telling, you know, unsavory stories of Lenin. Because for the most part, they liked him, you know, and he treated them well. And they enjoyed each other, and what they found was a good, decent man who everybody wanted something from, and he was still just really cool about it.
Well, he was.
So I admired Lenin going in, and by the end of it, all the more. You know, he fought the fight.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And he was real supportive of Elephant's Memory, trying to help them any way he could. And, you know, not what you would necessarily expect. Well,
I think he's, you know, what they found that a lot of people did, he surprised people in that way. You know, he had his moments, he had his tempers, but he also, in New York in particular, the way he treated, shall we say, normal folks. I mean, yeah, he might have had studio fights with musicians or at least one other Beatle, but that was, you know, at work. But he was just basically, you know, a good, generous guy to most everyone he ran into. Until somebody crossed him or tried to use him.
Yeah.
And he cut it off. And I think he felt that way. He didn't abandon the movement because of his green card. He did put a distance between Jerry Rubin, because Rubin would not promise to be nonviolent at protests. You know, and that's where Lenin drew the line.
Yes. That is something that Lenin made very clear, that it had to, you know, it had to be nonviolent, and but that he wanted to make a difference. And I'm really glad that you wrote this book. I think you bring out some really interesting things. I know there's so much more that we haven't been able to touch on, but thanks for spending this time with us this evening. I do appreciate it.
I'm glad to do it and appreciate the time to chat. And the book's available out there, Easy Enough Title to Remember, and you can find it at it was on Barnes & Noble or through the publisher, Seven Stories Press.
It's The Walrus and the Elephants, John Lennon's Year of Revolution, by James Mitchell. James, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. And we're going to go to a couple of announcements, and then we'll be back with a talk that David Barsanian gave here in Houston.
The National Committee to Free the Cuban Five was formed in 2001, within weeks of the unjust conviction in a trial held in Miami. The committee has worked tirelessly to create public awareness of the anti-terrorist missions of the Cuban Five and to create support for the demand that the United States government should free the Cuban Five and let them return to Cuba. The National Committee to Free the Cuban Five has also been active in the legal area, spearheading investigations into aspects of the case which have formed an integral part of appeals made by lawyers for the Five. For more information about the case of the Cuban Five, to get involved, to make donations, and more, you can visit freethefive.org.
KPFT Houston.
Don't think you can make a difference? Be part of an effort that can revolutionize the radio station you know and love. By joining KPFT's Sustainer program, you can support your station and help KPFT reduce its pledge drives. What's a Sustainer? Rather than giving a yearly gift, Sustainers give a monthly donation that continues as long as you want. Giving 5, 20, 100, or more monthly helps change the way KPFT operates. From having to meet our operating expenses through days and days of on-air fundraising to friends of the station boosting it off-air throughout the fiscal year. Contact our development director at 713-526-4000 to inquire about our Sustainer program. You can also visit kpft.org. Make a difference today. This is KPFT Houston.
Yes, you are listening to KPFT, the programs of Progressive Forum. I'm Wally James. And next we're going to have a talk that I recorded back on February 26. This is David Barsanian. He was here in Houston, and he has recently written a book with Noam Chomsky titled Power Systems. He was talking about that and other things. And David's the founder and director of Alternative Radio, which can be heard here on KPFT Friday mornings at 5 a.m. And this event was co-sponsored by KPFT, Voices Breaking Boundaries, and the Houston Institute for Culture.
Fill all the agency files. UAVs rain death from the skies. Pilotless drones will blow out your eyes. Government agents, look out! Here comes the FBI. IEDs, RPGs, WMDs, CIA, NSC, DEA. There goes the USA. There goes the USA. There goes the USA. It's a little ditty I wrote. You know, the great Canadian songwriter and poet Leonard Cohen once wrote a song called Democracy is Coming to the USA. We can see it fading from the USA and the national security state that has been constructed using the pretext of September 11th to justify all various sorts of illegal activities and surveillance. I have here in my hand, it's a document that some of you may have heard of. It's called the Constitution of the United States of America, First Amendment, Fourth Amendment. Anyone remember those things? Yeah, there are a few people. The ACLU will remind you once in a while. But basically, this document has been shredded and tattered into little pieces to mean virtually nothing. And it's really important, you know, that in a time of this kind of I use the word fascist very carefully because I think it's overused, but let's say near fascist-like government intervention and intrusion in all aspects of our lives. I mean, just, again, go to the scare ports. That's what I call them. There you have a confrontation yourself with the TSA and frisking and come with me and open your pockets and empty your pockets out and all of that. Years ago, I invented a media anchor called Dick Veneer. I don't know if you're familiar with Dick. He's a tremendous investigative journalist. And Dick would like to make a little presentation for you right now. We interrupt this program from the Houston Institute for Culture to bring you this breaking news story from TIBC, the Truth in Broadcasting Corporation, from our world corporate headquarters in a secure underground location in Area 51 in Nevada. I'm Dick Veneer, your glib and banal anchor of Facade News, the 24/7 newscast dedicated to keeping you in the dark. We go straight to the surface of a story, and we stay there. No one can challenge our in-shallow reporting. Our credos, unfair and unbalanced. We deceive, you believe. Ladies and gentlemen, an amazing story coming across our news desk at this very moment. According to KPFT in Houston, Texas, they are reporting that Ben Bernanke, Hank Paulson, Alan Greenspan, Timothy Geithner, Larry Summers, Lloyd Blankfein, and the entire staff of Goldman Sachs have been arrested for financial crimes against the people and planet Earth. Also taken into custody were Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Cokie Roberts, and Wolf Blitzer for lying to the American people. Imagine that. They were all found in locked embrace in a bunker under Minute Maid Park. With trillions of dollars in cash and a stash of World Wrestling CDs and scores of Papa John's pizza boxes and a massive collection of Kenny G and Barry Manilow CDs. The arrests were made by a heretofore unknown group calling itself HLF, the Houston Liberation Front. According to Seba, who refused to give her last name, she said, "This action is long overdue. We're dedicated to nonviolence and did not use force. But we had to act. We could no longer wait for the Obama administration to do something and enforce the law. They must face justice," she said, her voice rising in indignation. "The prisoners in foot shackles and handcuffs in orange jumpsuits and with black cloaks over their head were later reportedly defiantly saying to their captors, 'Do you know who we are? We're the masters of the universe. We rule the world.' And then, inexplicably, each one of them burst into tears and said, 'I want my mommy.'" If convicted, they'll do time in Guantanamo. You'll remember the infamous U.S. base that was turned back to Cuban sovereignty in 2014. It looks like curtains for the smartest guys in the universe. Their heads were bowed as they were led away by blue-helmeted peacekeepers of HLF, the Houston Liberation Front, headed by Commander Massoud. I'm Dick Veneer, your still glib and banal anchor. Stay tuned to Facade News on the TIBC network for updates on this breaking news story. Remember, we deceive, you believe. You either watch our news or you will be watched. Now back to our regularly scheduled program at the Houston Institute for Culture. How about that, Dick Veneer? Tremendous journalism. Certainly the equivalent of any of, Diane Sawyer or Katie Couric or Brian Williams and the other, anchors. Why are they called anchors, as Howard Zinn used to say? Because they're anchored to the establishment. That's a good reason that they're called anchors. And, of course, they're making millions and millions of dollars in salaries and benefits and perks, a little bit more than I make and people in this audience make. And somehow, they manage to make ends meet. Well, I think, the corporate media are an obvious target, and the concentration of media should be clear to everyone. As we speak, Comcast is about to absorb, take over Time Warner to make it yet another cable conglomerate. And in case you haven't noticed, front page of the New York Times talking about the year that just passed, 2013, for stocks, an amazingly good year is the headline. And indeed, it was an amazingly good year for the stock market, but not for the average American and American worker who still struggles to make ends meet. And tens of millions of people are still unemployed or underemployed, working part-time jobs, unable, and many people have simply dropped out. So they're not even in the government calculations of unemployed, because they're not actively seeking work. They've been so discouraged by what is out there. And this has been part of a trend in corporate capitalism in the United States that really takes form and shape in the 1970s. After all of that enormous pushback and upheaval and demonstrations and protests and groups that before had never organized were organizing and demanding rights like equal pay, civil rights, voting rights, etc., there was an enormous pushback from the establishment. This is when actually wages go flat in the 1970s. A huge attack is launched on unions, making it more and more difficult for unions to organize. Corporations discover countries like Bangladesh and the Ivory Coast and Pakistan and other places where they can offshore their production. So a lot of manufacturing jobs disappear from the United States. Workers are not making more money, although U.S. productivity is very, very high throughout this period. So what do they figure out as a kind of something for the workers to do? Give them credit cards. This is when you have the explosion of credit. And I remember the period. I mean, a week didn't go by when some exciting new offer didn't come in the mail, you know, offering unlimited amounts of credit. And this is where, you know, the debt crisis, the individual debt crisis begins around this period. And corporate media concentration and mergers and takeovers also accelerate in the 70s and 80s. It went from a period, Ben Bagdikian is the kind of pioneering journalist who wrote a book called The Media Monopoly. When I was starting alternative radio in the late 70s, early 80s, and he identified 50 corporations as controlling most of the media in the United States, that number is down to five. Five corporations basically control what people determine what people see, hear, and read. And I think the corporate media should be seen as a national health problem. It should be because of the toxicity that it produces and the ignorance that it induces in the population really poses a threat to the communication needs of a democratic society. If we're going to talk about having access to a wide range of opinion and many, many different views and opinions, then the corporate media is simply failing at what it is doing. It is supine and obsequious. The journalists themselves are really practicing prostitution. It's their prostitutes. They're lapdogs with laptops. You know, they're stenographers to power. That's actually their societal function, is to repeat, basically, with changing some adverbs and adjectives around and, you know, definite and indefinite articles to give it a little personal flavor, but to replicate the, you know, the press releases coming out of the war machine of the Pentagon, the State Department, and the White House. And they're just like a recycling agency. And this can also be seen in all of the embedded ideas that the corporate media keep repeating about U.S. you know, intentions, its willingness and desire to bring democracy and freedom to peoples around the world, you know, while on the other hand, the actual policies are completely different, are counter to that. There is an undermining of democracy. There is not a desire to expand markets. There's a desire to monopolize markets, to take them over, to have capital penetration. For a long time, I lived in India, and India was kind of singular in the developing world in the 50s and 60s when it did not allow outside capital to come in. It did not allow the New York and London banks to come in and take over the financial system. That's, of course, changing now and has changed under the neoliberal doctrine that was so fervently embraced after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. But I don't want to be simply doom and gloom. There's some also very good news to report, if you can believe it or not. Al Jazeera is now broadcasting in English and is available to on most cable subscription packages. Again, I'm sorry we have to pay so much for cable and to have access to it, but Al Jazeera is certainly superior to a lot of the things that are being offered. RT TV, the Russian TV, also has some very interesting news programs. That too, you know, you might want to look at that. Then there's the BBC, which is gotten really, really soft, but occasionally does a good documentary or a good piece of investigative reporting. Exciting news came from Pierre Omidyar, the French-born, now Iranian-American citizen founder of eBay, who is now funding to the tune of $250 million. That's not chump change. $250 million to start First Look Media, and it has attracted Jeremy Scahill, Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and most recently Matt Taibbi has left Rolling Stone to join this new media venture. So this is very exciting. Sunday, Jeremy Scahill's documentary, Rick Rowley's documentary, I should say, and Jeremy, is up for an Oscar, Dirty Wars. So there's word is getting out about a lot of these issues, but you still have to, you know, get a little dirt under your fingernails to uncover this information. It's not going to be laid out for you readily available. There was also, of course, the Idle No More movement in Canada, fighting the same kind of movements that have taken place here in the United States against fracking, against tar sands. The Keystone XL pipeline is largely indigenous and it's largely women-driven. In the Canadian case, I was in Winnipeg fairly recently and met with a lot of these Idle No More people. They're very active in British Columbia. I was very interested to see that the CEO of ExxonMobil, you know that green corporation? They just love the environment. Whenever you see their ads on PBS, the news hour in the evening, there's, you know, it's green and people are dancing and laughing and singing, and it's all brought to you by ExxonMobil. Well, it turns out that the CEO of ExxonMobil, his name is Rex, his last name ends in two L's, Terracil or something. Anyway, he lives in Bartonville, right near Denton. And it turns out that he doesn't want any fracking near his huge mansion. Gee, I wonder why. Does he have some information about fracking that might, you know, be environmentally damaging and may cause the property values of his home to collapse? Maybe he has that information, but he's definitely opposing that particular project. It has a lot to do with, of course, using water, and even though it rained last night and it's been raining on and off today, you are in a water-stressed area of the country, as I am in Colorado, as New Mexico is, in Arizona and Nevada, and crucially, the Central Valley of California. Water is going to be a major security issue, because if we don't have water, if we don't have sufficient supplies of water, food production is going to diminish, food prices are going to skyrocket, and in the view of many people, it will be a source of conflict in the future. There was a very prescient World Bank vice president from Malaysia in the mid-1990s, he said this, Ismail Sarageldin. He said that the wars of the future, the wars of the past were about gold and silver and ivory, and right now the wars are about oil. But in the future, it's going to be about water. And I can't stress this enough. I've traveled throughout the Himalayan ranges from Nepal to India.
This is KPFT, Houston, 90.1 Pacifica Radio. The program's The Progressive Forum. We're listening to a talk by David Barsanian, Director of Alternative Radio. This was recorded in Houston on February 26th.
Himalayan ranges from Nepal to India to Pakistan, and have seen these enormous glaciers contract. But you don't even have to go that far. You can just go to Colorado. You can just come to Boulder with your own eyes. And I have seen this in the last few years. Major glaciers have shrunk dramatically. So, you know, despite the corporate tidal wave of propaganda that the jury is still out and scientists disagree about whether the climate temperature is heating up, water is evaporating, on all of these issues, I think the evidence is unmistakable that something seriously is amiss in a radical way with our climate, and I'll talk about more about that in a moment or two. And also good news has been the remarkable heroism of Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, two citizens you know, who didn't wait for that Pastor Niemöller formulation of, you know, first they came for the communists and I didn't say anything because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the socialists and the gays and I didn't say anything because I wasn't a socialist or a gay. Then they came for the gypsies. Then they came for the Jews. And then when they came for me, there was no one left to stand up for me. They stood up. They acted in a supremely moral way. And if there were any justice in this country, Obama, who received a Nobel Prize, you know, I think totally undeservedly, he would turn over that Nobel Prize to these people who deserve it. And Manning would be released from jail. And Chelsea Manning would be released from a 22-year sentence that he was given. You know, people who do far worse crimes, crimes in the suites, crimes on Wall Street and in, you know, in the banking sector, they do enormous, irreparable harm to families and children all over the country by decisions that they make. They get taps on the wrist. You know, here and there you get, you know, Bernie Madoff will get 150 years. Most recently, the SAC trader was convicted for insider trading, the biggest insider trading scheme in history. His last name is Matarum, Matthew Matarum. And, you know, there are a few others like that. Raj Rajaratnam of the Galleon hedge fund in New York. Ranjit Gupta was also convicted. So a handful of these people are trotted out, you know, and given stiff sentences. And then, you know, the power elite kind of thump their, you know, chests and say, look, we're, you know, we're protecting you. But the real criminals are getting off scot-free. There's barely, you know, and you see a little bit of that in The Wolf of Wall Street. Have you any of you seen that new Martin Scorsese film about Jordan Belfort, who sold these penny stocks and ripped many, many people off? He got 22 months. You know, if you, you know, steal a pizza, you might get a term that of that length. But here's someone who pauperized people with his immoral business practices, eviscerated them, and gets 22 months, then writes a book, now is the subject of a Hollywood film, and becomes a celebrity. So, you know, it's truly astonishing when you see that kind of corporate capitalism and its predatory and rapacious nature, which, you know, Oliver Stone, I think, hinted at with the Gordon Gekko character in the late 1980s, greed is good. Well, this new character, Jordan Belfort, who's actually based on a real person, takes Gordon Gekko and just leaves him way behind in terms of venality and being so promiscuous with other people's money. There was great news from Seattle. A socialist candidate was elected to the city council, Kashama Sawant, someone of Indian origin, in nearby SeaTac. The workers there, that's right outside of Seattle, where the airport is, workers voted for a $15 an hour minimum wage. There are those kinds of things going on right now that I think, you know, are signs of hope. Democracy Now! Is just starting its 19th year. Alternative Radio is starting its 29th year. We're still here, and we're still, you know, we're still active, and we're still pushing the agenda. What is called the pro-Israeli lobby, suffered severe setbacks. Despite all of the propaganda about its, you know, tremendous power, it was unable to push through even more punitive sanctions against Iran, and it was unable to instigate U.S. military intervention in Syria as well. So those have been, I think, again, very positive developments. And as I mentioned, anti-fracking ordinances are popping up, and organizations are popping up all across the country. There's a lot of people that are very concerned about this exotic cocktail that is being injected into Mother Earth with lots of fresh water to extract more oil and gas. And then finally, we have the amazing emergence of the Pope himself sounding like a total Marxist. I mean, have any of you been reading? The idea that a free market will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness in the world has never been confirmed by the facts. While the earnings of a minority are growing exponentially, the 1%, so too is the gap separating the majority from the prosperity enjoyed by those happy few. The imbalance is the result of ideologies which defend the absolute autonomy of the marketplace and financial speculation. Today's economic mechanisms promote inordinate consumption, yet it is evident that unbridled consumerism combined with inequality proves doubly damaging to the social fabric. Inequality eventually engenders a violence which recourse to arms cannot and never will be able to be resolved. Today, everything comes under the laws of competition and the survival of the fittest, where the powerful feed upon the powerless. As a consequence, masses of people find themselves excluded and marginalized without work, without possibilities, without any means of escape. And just yesterday, to show you the shift in Rome, for whatever it's worth, I don't want to overstate it, but I think it is symbolic, the Pope invited Gustavo Gutierrez to the Vatican. Does that ring a bell? Anyone goes back to the 70s and 80s? He was the Peruvian priest who formulated the notion of liberation theology, that the church had a moral obligation to support the poor against the autocrats, against the plutocrats. They were rooted out by the much hallowed and venerated Pope John. He sent his main executioner, who later became Pope Benedict, to Central America and South America, and really conducted a purge of all of those priests that practiced the gospel of Christ, practiced liberation theology. I mean, they weren't executed in that sense, but they were informally executed by being sent into remote villages in faraway places and not having any access to mainstream media and discourse. So that is a really, I think, important development that we should take note of. And, you know, how does change happen? Because people always ask me, well, you know, how does change happen? Well, Howard Zinn said, small acts multiplied 1,000 times is how change happens. Nobody knows what's going to set off a particular movement. If you would have said on November 30th, 1955, that it's the next day, if Rosa Parks did not sit down in the back of the bus, as she was ordered to, that would launch the Montgomery bus boycott, people thought, you're probably nuts. Well, it's not going to happen. They tried it 3 or 4 times before, and it didn't work. But that was the palito. That was the little spark that ignited that flame in Montgomery, Alabama. Later, when 4 students, young guys, sitting down at a lunch counter in North Carolina, in Greensboro, that set off yet another wave of protests. So it's always these small acts, and we don't know when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen. The Occupy movement, which many of you witnessed yourselves, perhaps even participated in, was totally unpredicted. And it just kind of happened. It was ignited. There was a call from a Canadian, radical Canadian magazine called Adbusters saying, get your bottoms down to Wall Street and occupy it. And some people did. And it happened. It happened. Now, where that spark will come in the future, it is difficult to say. I talked to Chomsky particularly about these issues in this new book, but I think there's a couple of things I want to read to you about the environment and the destruction of the environment and how that's linked to the capitalist economic system, which again will always focus on the rotten apples, like those characters I just named, Bernie Madoff, Rajaratnam, Matthew Macaram, and the others. The rotten apples are focused on and highlighted, but the barrel entirely escapes scrutiny. And the barrel is the economic system. The institutions that keep producing this, this dysfunction. And that's where the media, which is so locked into the establishment, that's where it comes to the fore in focusing just on these malefactors of great wealth, as T.R. called them, Teddy Roosevelt called them, 100 years ago during another surge in corporate criminality. So talking about the environment, I asked Chomsky, what are they doing? I mean, why aren't these corporations paying attention to what they're doing? It's an institutional imperative. By imperative, I don't mean it's a law of nature. You can change it. But given the way institutions now function, their core goal is to maximize short-term profit and power. That is a critical element for the core of decision makers in the economy and the society, and therefore in the political system, which I should say is awash in corporate cash. Years ago, Ralph Nader offhandedly and jokingly once said, that all of our so-called representatives in Washington, they should have numbers on their back corresponding to the corporations that own them. So, like number seven would be, let's say, Chevron, Texaco. Number 14 would be Lockheed Martin. 21 would be Bank of America, and so on. Then people would understand, there's the vote for Bank of America. There's the one who's been bought by Bank of America. I mean, other than Bernie Sanders and one or two other people, can you think of anyone in the House or the Senate that we can really feel, represent the people, represent democracy, represent our interests against the 1%? It's that situation, of course, has to change. It can only change by public financing of elections, a genuine second party, because I've had it up to here with the Duma Democrats and the Thuglicans. They're basically two sides of the same coin. There's some slight differences, particularly on social issues, but on issues of imperialism, there's not any bit of space between those two parties. On issues of corporate capitalism and support for corporate capitalism, there's virtually no difference between these two parties. We need proportional representation. We need public financing. We need elections on the weekends so that more people can conveniently vote. I mean, this is nuts. I mean, this is like such an obvious thing. Any moron could think of this. Why on a working day is there elections? Is it difficult to get to the polls? Of course, it's difficult for people who commute, who drive long distances, to get to their local polling place. It should be either on the weekend or a national holiday should be enacted. I mean, these are very simple kinds of things that could be done to enhance the system. But we need candidates. We need a party that represents the people rather than the corporate interests. And as long as that's not happening, as long as we're groveling to the Democrats for little crumbs, the bakery and the distribution and ownership of bread in the United States remains with the 1%. And here and there, we'll get our little crumb and be grateful and thank you and go our merry way. So all of these things are, I think, front and center in terms of an agenda. Chomsky warns that victories don't come quickly. So we're not in a sprint here. It's a marathon. And he says, yes, it's a marathon, one in which you often go backwards. There's regression, too. The last 30 years have been, in some respects, a period of regression, although in popular activism, it's been an expansion. History is never simple. And you see, again, in other things where he talks about what's happening with education. Now, yesterday I spoke at the University of Houston. I speak at universities and colleges all across the country. And it's the same song everywhere. Tuition is skyrocketing. Textbooks, price of textbooks are also escalating. And this unique thing that they've figured out is an increase in fees, student fees for this, for the athletic team, for the new gym, for the swimming pool, for the rec center. Fees are being imposed and prices are going up. Education has become commodified. We're not thinking about the value and the gift that education should be for society. It's become yet a profit-making engine for capitalism. The federal budget has shrunk to the states, and state budgets have shrunk to the universities and colleges. So in Boulder, where I live, where the University of Colorado has its home campus, tuitions have gone way up. So what happens? The kids go into debt, or their parents go into debt, and they're, trying to make ends meet. And when they do graduate, if they face not only the prospect of no work, because that's the reality out there right now, unless you want to get a job at Wendy's or Burger King or Pizza Hut and things like that, they're saddled with this insurmountable debt. I know people that hundreds of thousands of dollars in the hole with, very poor outcomes in terms of getting, out from under debt. So this is what Chomsky says about education, which I think has become a real battleground in this state and in other states around the country. A lot of the concerns people articulated were that public education system is under serious attack, both by defunding and by charter schools, which are breaking up the community and undermining the basic contributions of public education, which are quite real. In California, which is one of the richest places in the world, but is now under severe budgetary constraints, the major public universities, Berkeley and UCLA, the jewels in the crown, are effectively being privatized. They're not very different from Ivy League universities now. Tuitions are sky high. They have endowments. At the same time, the state college system is being downgraded, so much so that students and teachers are planning a rolling strike against budgetary cuts. California State University announced it's just going to refuse to accept any students for the next spring term. One of the amazing things that's happened in recent years is the corporatization of the universities, which shows up in many ways. There's been a rapid increase in the number of administrators and layers of administration. They bring in a corporate mentality. Each new administrator has to have a sub-administrator, and that one has to have a sub-something else. Meanwhile, the role of the faculty in running the university is sharply declining. All of these developments are part of the general assault on education, which we should remember is part of a much larger assault on the whole society. That's what the neoliberal program is all about. And you can see also, and this was borne out by comments made at the University of Houston yesterday from faculty and students, that they're hiring more adjuncts and TAs, teacher assistants, And they're like, you know, they're working like on a dollar scale, a per hour scale. There are no benefits. They're overworked. They're being exploited as a new kind of, I don't want to use a term like slave labor, but it is a kind of wage slavery that they're locked into. Meanwhile, teachers, professors who have dedicated their lives, spent decades doing research and teaching and, you know, and developing their skills and art, because teaching really is a form of art, they're being retired and being replaced by these adjuncts and TAs. So you see the corporatization there too, and I think that's something that we have to be very aware of. Now, how are we doing on time? And does anyone have any water? By any chance, yes, water.
I have some water in my car.
I have some water in this car, okay. There's beer back there. I want to thank you. We've been rescued here. I want to read you something. Human beings and the natural world are on a collision course. Human activities inflict harsh and often irreversible damage on the environment and on critical resources. If not checked, many of our current practices put at serious risk the future that we wish for human society and the plant and animal kingdom, and may so alter the living world that it will be unable to sustain life in the manner that we know. Fundamental changes are urgent. If we are to avoid the collision our present course will bring about. Anyone recognize that statement? It was not from the Pope. This is from 1992. Over 1,600 scientists, over 100 Nobel laureates issued this proclamation, this announcement that there was something seriously wrong with the environment. And if we continue on the course we are pursuing, we are risking so much that we take for granted. That is to say, Mother Earth herself, Gaia, this pale blue dot in the universe, as Carl Sagan described Earth, this amazing life that exists here, is for the first time in millions of years in peril. And I think particularly for those of you, you know, have children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, you have to be thinking about these issues, about what's happening to Mother Nature and how will we sustain ourselves in a planet that is being looted and plundered of its resources, whose water supplies are being depleted and not replenished, and fracking goes a long way toward that, where pipelines are being proposed to be built from northern Alberta to the Gulf Coast right here in Texas. If those tar sands, if that tar sand oil is developed, James Hansen, who's the first scientist to publicly talk about global warming in congressional testimony in 1988, he noticed that something was happening with the climate. It was gradually getting warmer because of the emission of carbons and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. He said it will be a game changer. It will be tip over, you know, get the tipping point. Now, I know you hear that a lot from Bill McKibben and other environmentalists, that this is a tipping point, that's a tipping point. I don't think there's any doubt that we're coming dangerously close to passing certain markers that will be irreversible. And then it will only be about containing the damage. The damage will have been done, and then it will be about, you know, trying to revive the patient with some cosmetics and maybe a little lipstick and eye blusher and things like that. So I think, you know, this issue, it should be paramount. And if people ask me, well, what can you do? A practical thing would be not to have that Keystone XL pipeline approved. And Obama has that on his desk right now. So if you want to call the White House, and I'm not a big fan of email petitions because I hear they get easily deleted, but they do open letters. Letters still have an impact on politicians because it's something tactile. A petition of 25,000 names, You know, it's not, it's electronic. It can be disappeared and is disappeared. Calls and letters to the White House do not approve the Keystone XL pipeline. That's very, very critical. And it's unclear what explains this, the reticence is it unclear? Someone is posing this question. The reticence in this political system to address this obvious crisis. I mean, it's not about moving deck chairs on the Titanic. It's about stopping and turning the ship around, because these cosmetic changes are not going to save the planet. It's not going to reverse global warming. So no matter how many Priuses we drive, no matter how much plastic and paper and cardboard we recycle, no matter how much composting we may do, it's not going to reverse the fundamental issue of what's happening to the Earth in terms of heating up of the atmosphere. And there will be enormous repercussions. There will be not only wars and conflicts, there'll be climate refugees. People will be moving, and it's already starting in the South Pacific. Places like Florida are exposed, Bangladesh, Pakistan, a lot of coastal areas around the world will be soon submerged if these very conservative, and I want to underline that word, conservative estimates by scientists, because they're very careful about predictions. If these very conservative estimates are realized, then we're going to see transformations that are absolutely unimaginable. And I've been to northern Alberta. If you want to get a picture of what those tar sands look like, have you seen Avatar? It kind of looks like that. It's mass desolation. There's earth-moving equipment that's the size of this room. I mean, the tires are literally the size of this room. Enormously, huge and destructive. So that's what's going on. Native peoples there are being adversely affected. Rare cancers have been discovered throughout northern Alberta. In the Athabasca River there is polluted. It's a river that Native peoples in Canada, they're called First Nations, depend on for not just transportation, but for food, for fish, all being contaminated. That is accelerating, and Canada itself, in many ways, and Chomsky talks about this in the book, is outdoing the U.S. in environmental destruction. It is the leading mining power in the world, from Papua New Guinea to East Africa to India. Canadian corporations are very, very active in the mining and extractive sectors. So given all of these things, why then is the political system not responding? It can't respond because it is owned and controlled by the oil and natural gas interests. It should be fairly, transparent that they are doing the bidding of what their paymasters are demanding. And that, of course, they have to be called out on that. And we need democracy in the U.S. We need a system of governance where the people, the demos, are ruling and not the corporations. And now we're, basically in a corporatocracy. I think, again, a lot of you listeners to KPFT, have heard these kinds of arguments. And I think, we need to make them over and over again in new ways and in creative ways. You can look, there's all of this documentation now about what's happening to the environment. There shouldn't be any doubt in people's minds. Although the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and others are funding fake science, and they recruit fake scientists to sign documents saying, that, well, it's not clear, and it could be, and it may be not, and change always happens, and this is just a temporary thing. The risk is too great. And the scientific evidence is, as I said, overwhelming, almost 100%. And we have to think about protecting future generations. So I'm talking to you, to grandparents here, to parents and future parents. Think about the future. Are we going to leave a better place for future generations, or a place that's contaminated and polluted and has been spoiled because of this kind of reckless, rapacious, predatory capitalism that is totally devoted to profits uber alles. It's all about making more and more money. What happens to the planet? That's somebody else's problem down the line. I'm a CEO. I'm about maximizing profits now. That system is what, of course, is eroding and is eating in a very pernicious way our very life. And I remember, Chief Seattle is reported to have said he noticed that, you know, there was these white settlers that were coming west. They had this enormous capacity and desire for material things, acquisition of goods. We want more and more things. And he said prophetically that if you keep soiling the bed you sleep in, that is our planet, then you will ultimately choke on your own toxic fumes. That, I think, is words of prophecy. Bernie Sanders, one of the aforementioned, you know, few good people in Washington, says, I fear very much that our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren are going to look back on this period in history and ask a very simple question. Where were they? Why didn't the United States lead in cutting greenhouse gas emissions and preventing the devastating damage that the scientific community was sure to come? Well, I just got a sign to kind of wind it up, but I'm not ready to wind it up. And if you can stay with me for a little bit, we're going to keep rocking the Kasbah here. One of the things, another great development has been the explosion in worker co-ops. Thousands of worker co-ops have sprung up all across the United States, some of them inspired by Mondragon. This remarkable experiment that started in 1956 in the Spanish Basque Country by this is the most destitute area of Spain. I mean, there was a lot of hostility toward the Basque, and so there was no money going into that area. A Spanish priest, a Catholic priest named Arizmendez, started a cooperative. And just a couple of people, farmers, they got together and started farming the land. It has grown since then to be the seventh largest business enterprise in all of Spain. It has over 100,000 employees. And it's not just about farmers. They build furniture, they handicrafts. There's all kinds of industries within Mondragon. And I was very encouraged recently to learn that unions in Pittsburgh are now studying the Mondragon model and seeing what can be applied in the U.S. Context. A lot of these co-ops may not be known to you, like Land of Lakes Butter. I recently learned that it's a worker-run co-op. So is Ace Hardware. So is Nationwide Insurance. When I was in the Mission District in San Francisco a few months ago, I was walking along and I looked up. It was on Valencia Street. And I said, there was a sign that said, worker owned and operated. And it was the Arizmendez Bakery and Cafe, named after that Basque priest. And there's a whole series of these bakeries and cafes in the San Francisco Bay Area that is worker owned and operated. So this is a very positive development, and we need to create more workplace democracy. And that's, you know, poco a poco, things are changing in that direction. Now, the other thing I want to say, so many things I want to say, but about the military and what it's doing to the country, because that's another component of all of this. There is no, even more than the oil and gas petrochemical complex, the Pentagon is the number one polluter in the world, with its aircraft carriers and jet planes and tanks and all the rest. And I think, you know, the founding fathers, they love to quote the founding fathers, but they're very selective in their quotes, you'll notice. So like when James Madison, and he's one of the major theoreticians of the U.S. Republic, I mean, he basically wrote the Federalist Papers. I mean, Hamilton wrote a couple, but Madison wrote most of them. He was a two-time president. He was at the president of the Constitutional Convention. You know what he said to the question, what is the function of government? You'll never hear this answer on ABC, NBC, CBS, or CNN. He said the function of government is to protect the opulent minority against the majority. I'll repeat that. The function of government, the aim of government, is to protect the opulent minority against the majority. Now, if that's not the 1%, 99% formula, I don't know what is. But so you won't hear that Madison quoted at all. But here's an interesting thing he also had to say about the war machine and this enormous complex where Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and Boeing are just raking in the dollars while schools and hospitals and clinics and healthcare centers and daycare centers are being closed or cut back and teachers are being laid off, school districts are being consolidated. No money for that sector, but tons of money for those corporations that I just named. This is what Madison said at the 1787 Constitutional Convention. Constant apprehension of war has the same tendency to render the head too large for the body. A standing military force with an overgrown executive will not long be safe companions to liberty. The means of defense against foreign danger have always been the instruments of tyranny at home. Now, this should be in sharp relief given what we've gone through since 2001. Using the pretext of terrorism and terrorist attacks, you know, there's a book I have here with Iqbal Ahmed. It's called Terrorism, Theirs and Ours. You know, terrorism is in the eyes of the beholder. For years, the State Department called Nelson Mandela a terrorist. In fact, he couldn't get a visa to come to the United States, even after he was elected president of South Africa, after he was released from prison on Robben's Island in South Africa. So he was a terrorist, and then, of course, when he died, everybody came out of the woodwork. Oh, we love Nelson Mandela. He was great. He was the second coming of Buddha, of Gandhi. What a wonderful model. You know, everybody was falling over themselves. Well, for years, the Reagan administration classified the African National Congress and Nelson Mandela, the ANC as a terrorist organization, and Mandela as a terrorist. So, you know, which eyes, which lenses are you looking through at what particular moment? Now, if a picture is worth a million words, the picture of that book, and I think I have several copies of it back there with Iqbal Ahmed, has Reagan meeting the Afghan Mujahideen in the Oval Office in 1986. This is a photo that this book came out in 2000. Very prescient, by the way, because Iqbal Ahmed said Osama bin Laden is a sign of things to come. He said that in 1998, and that's in the book. And so we got this photograph of Reagan sitting with the Afghan Mujahideen. Who are these guys? They're homicidal maniacs. They're drug traffickers. They're misogynists. They're patriarchs. They're homophobes. And here, there is the leader of the free world, you know, not only mingling with them, welcoming them, calling them the moral equivalent of the founding fathers. I mean, maybe Reagan knew something about the founding fathers. He actually may have been right about that. And calling them freedom fighters. And these are the very people who then became the Taliban and the Afghan Mujahideen and, you know, and some of them morphed into Al-Qaeda as well. Now, a funny thing happened on the way to the forum. About a year ago, we went back to the Reagan archive where we got this photograph from. And I've been talking about this for the last 10 years or so. I like to think that maybe I contributed to this bit of subversion. The photo has now been removed from the archive. So those of you who remember the Soviet Union when, you know, up at the podium with Stalin or Khrushchev, you know, there'd be this general and this commissar and this minister, but then one of them would fall out of favor, and then the next year when the photo was published, well, there was only three people up on the podium, you know, and I thought there were four. And then the year after that, another minister falls out of favor. He's dispatched to a gulag somewhere. And now it's just, you know, Comrade Stalin standing there all alone, and all of these people have disappeared. This was actively done in the Soviet Union. This is before there was Photoshop, incidentally. So it took quite a bit of artistry to white out Trotsky and Bukharin and the other dissidents fell out of favor. So the photo has been removed from the archive. The date is still there. It's the spring of 1986, but no photo. It's now apparently too embarrassing for the Reagan National Library archive to have this photo there. And, you know, those kinds of things don't just occur in the Soviet Union. They happen here as well. Now, I want to just tell you about, we are living in a time of an imperialist foreign policy. This basically hasn't changed since 1945. It's been a monochromatic one-note samba. The U.S. has either been at war or is about to go to war on a continual basis. There's an absolute continuum. And there was, you know, there's been some talk now about reducing the Pentagon war budget. Don't be fooled by that. What they're doing is ramping up high-tech special operations, very lethal weapons, and guess what? Doing away with an attack plane that was designed to attack Soviet tanks as they came through Western Europe. This, and Hagel, the defense secretary, actually the war secretary, said, we don't need this kind of weapon anymore. Hello? The Soviet Union collapsed 24 years ago. Why weren't these planes decommissioned then? Why were they still being produced? Why do we need 11 aircraft carrier battle groups? No other country has one. Why do we need Trident submarines? Why do we need all of this gold-plated weaponry in order to intimidate the rest of the world, to garrison the world, to say, we rule, you kiss my hand. If you don't, you will be dealt with in a very severe manner. And it never ends, and it will never end unless we stop it. And Joseph Schumpeter, an Australian sociologist, had a sense of this. And every time I said the word Rome or Roman, just insert the word American or United States and see if you feel some resonance with what's going on today. There was no corner of the world, Schumpeter said, where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, then they would be invented. When it was utterly impossible to contrive such an interest, why then it was the national honor that was insulted. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was Rome's duty to guard against their aggressive designs. If you go to September 2013 and read Obama's speech to the United Nations, it is this language that America is indispensable. It is unique. No one else can perform the tasks that history, providence, or God, these are like magical words now. You know, it's not like we wanted to be an empire. It just kind of happened. You know, we're driving down Highway 66, and all of a sudden we pulled over to the side of the road, and there was imperialism, and we had to embrace it. Now, this was by design. Those are words of obfuscation to confuse people. Oh, it's divine, by divine grace. It's not divine grace. This is an active policy. It's a result of mostly men meeting in secret, you know, much like the National Football League in huddles, and attacking the other team. There are a lot of similarities between football and U.S. foreign policy, by the way. Even now, the language that they're using of, you know, throwing bombs and, kill the quarterback and things like that. Now, I want to conclude. That's an applause line, folks. All right. Well, this might rock things up a little bit. First of all, Urdu is a wonderful language. It's a composite language spoken by hundreds of millions of people in North India and Kashmir. In Pakistan as well, it has elements of Farsi and Hindi and Arabic, even some Turkish. And the greatest Urdu poet of the 20th century was Faiz Ahmed Faiz. He was born in Sialkot in Pakistan, was then British India, in 1911, and he died in 1984. His poems are read and known throughout South Asia, even in Bangladesh and in other places. And wherever there are demonstrations, people who don't even know Urdu, they have signs up that just say bol. So bol is the word, the imperative to speak out. And I live in Boulder, Colorado, where there's the Naropa Institute of Poetry that Allen Ginsberg and Ann Waldman started. And, you know, we have poetry readings there. And they're so happy and thrilled if 50 or 60 people turn out for a poetry reading. They say, wow, there's a lot of interest in Boulder in poetry. Well, in South Asia, 50, 60, 70,000 people turn out to hear poems read. And it's a remarkable cultural event of community. Even people who are technically illiterate know poetry. So when the poet says the first line of a poem, of a sher, the people respond. They know immediately, and they say, va-va, and wow, like out of sight. It's quite a thing, and they go on for hours and hours, one poet after the other. So that oral tradition is still very strong. Anyway, Faiz was a journalist. He was a leftist. He was a communist and proud of it. He was jailed many times during the military dictatorship of Ayub Khan, fervently supported by the United States, incidentally, the Ayub Khan dictatorship in Pakistan. And this is his most famous poem, Bol. And it's spoken at demonstrations and protests everywhere. Bol ke lab azad hai tere, bol zaban ab tak teri hai. And my friend Farooq Ali translated this. Speak, speak up. Your lips are not yet, your lips are still free. Your tongue still your own. Your body, though famished and shriveled, is nevertheless your body. Speak as you are still alive. Look, the blacksmith's shop has a roaring flame going. The iron is red hot. The locks are opening. And so are all the links in every chain. Speak up. The short time we have is, in fact, plenty of time. Speak up before the body and tongue atrophies. Speak up, because the truth is still alive. Speak up and say whatever you have to say. But speak bold. And I think, as cultural workers, as independent media, as citizens, we always have to think of art as a way to bridge gaps, as a way to expand consciousness. Because it's through art, through poetry, through music, that ideas are transmitted and become real in a very different way that's very important. So I'm really glad to be surrounded by art here this evening. I think it's very, very significant. Marge Piercy is a great American poet. Her collection, The Moon is Always Female, is absolutely brilliant. And this poem speaks a lot to what I've been kind of suggesting this evening, the need for solidarity, the need for community, the need for collective action. The low road. What can they do to you? Whatever they want, they can set you up, they can bust you, they can break your fingers, they can burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can do anything. You can't stop them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone, you can fight, you can refuse, you can take what revenge you can, but they roll over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration. 100 fill a hall. 1,000, and you have your own community radio station, KPFT. That's not Marge Piercy. I just improvised that in there. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again and again, and they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean, and each day you mean one more. Marge Piercy. I was also going to read a poem by Constantine Cavafy, a wonderful Greek-Egyptian poet who died in the 1930s. This was Edward Said's favorite poem, Waiting for the Barbarians. And I think, again, given what's happened in the country since September 11th and this manufacturing of fear and the layers of TSA and security and screenings and NSA and spying and surveillance and all of these things, who are the barbarians? So this was Edward Said's favorite poem, Waiting for the Barbarians. What are we waiting for, assembled in the forum? The barbarians are due here today. Why isn't anything happening in the Senate? Why do the senators just sit there without legislating? Because the barbarians are coming today. What laws can the senators make now? Once the barbarians are here, they'll do all the legislating. Why did our emperor get up so early? And why is he sitting at the city's main gate on his throne wearing the crown? Because the barbarians are coming today and the emperor is waiting to receive their leader. He has even prepared a scroll to give them, replete with titles and imposing names. Why have our two consuls come out today wearing their embroidered scarlet togas? Why have they put on their gold bracelets and rings sparkling with magnificent emeralds? Why are they carrying elegant canes beautifully worked in silver and gold? Because the barbarians are coming today, and things like that dazzle the barbarians. Why don't our distinguished orators come forward as usual to make their speeches, say what they have to say? Because the barbarians are coming today, and they're bored by rhetoric and public speaking. Why this sudden restlessness, this confusion? How serious people's faces have become. Why are the streets and squares emptying so rapidly? Everyone going home so lost in thought? Because night has fallen and the barbarians have not come. And some who have just returned from the border say, there are no barbarians. And now what's going to happen to us without barbarians? They were those people, a kind of solution. Constantine Cavafy. Now, I'm going to... Poetry, read poetry. Read Neruda, read Amiri Baraka, who just passed away. Read W.H. Auden. Hear the hip-hop artists. Dr. Dre. I mean, there's a lot of great poetry out there. And it really stretches the mind in very imaginative ways. I think one of the most important works of art produced in the United States in the last century, and that is Gil Scott Heron's The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. He is the progenitor of hip-hop and rap. He's the godfather of this genre, and I've taken a few liberties with Gil Scott Heron's lyrics and have kind of sandpapered some of the sexist comments and injected a little bit of modernity into it. But this is sung or recited with Dizzy Gillespie's A Night in Tunisia. You will not be able to stay home, brothers and sisters. You'll not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You'll not be able to lose yourself on TV and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Citicorp, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, and JP Morgan Chase in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Donald Trump, or the Koch brothers. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by NPR, PBS, CBS, ABC, NBC, MSNBC, CNN, and Fox, and will not star Tom Cruise, Leonardo DiCaprio, Nicole Kidman, J-Lo, or Julie Roberts. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of zits. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds lighter. The revolution will not be televised. There'll be no pictures of you and Miley Cyrus, Katy Perry, Beyonce, Adele, Rihanna, or Lady Gaga, because the revolution will not be televised. There'll be no iPhones, iMacs, iPads, and iTunes, Masterpiece Theater, and Downton Abbey will no longer be relevant, and women will not care if Dick gets it on with Jane as the world turns, because people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There'll be no highlights on the 10 o'clock news with theme music sung by Frank Sinatra. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about white chocolate, white sheets, white flight, or white people. You will not have to worry about your hair falling out or the stains in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke, Pepsi, Sprite, or Diet 7-Up. The revolution will not fight the germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, not be televised, not be televised. The revolution will, there'll be no reruns, brothers and sisters. The revolution will be live. Gil Scott-Heron, thank you very much.
This is KPFT 90.1 Pacifica Radio in Houston. The program's The Progressive Forum. I'm Wally James, and we've been listening to a talk by David Barsanian. David is the founder and director of Alternative Radio, a program that we heard here on KPFT Friday mornings at 5 a.m. And we had brought David to town. He spoke at the Houston Peace and at the Houston Institute for Culture, and was back on February 26. He has a new book out with Noam Chomsky titled Power Systems. And this event was co-sponsored by KPFT, by Voices Breaking Boundaries, and the Houston Institute for Culture. Myself and Michael Woodson of Living Arts organized it and brought David. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any questions, you can call us down here. We'll be here for a couple more minutes. But mainly, go online. If you didn't get a chance to hear the whole talk or the whole show, go to archive.kpft.org, or just go to kpft.org and click on Listen on Demand. And before we go, I've got a couple of announcements for you. Coming up next week on our show, we're going to have an interview with Roy Zimmerman. And Roy's going to be playing, that's going to be on the 27th. And then on the 29th, he's going to be playing a benefit for the Houston Peace and Justice Center for their peace camp. And that's going to be at the Live Oak Friends Meeting House at 1318 West 26th Street. And it's going to be from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. There's going to be a potluck. And if you have any questions or you want to find out more, you can call 713-641-4941 or go to their website. That is hpjc.org. All right. Well, have a good evening. Stay tuned. Coming up next, we have Jacqueline Patis with People of Earth, and that's going to be followed by Hank Rubichek with What's Your Story? And then Scooter's going to roll in with The Inner Side. So a full evening. Stick around. We'll see you next week.
The Celts invade Houston on April 26th and 27th for a weekend of Scottish and Irish music, sports, food, and fun at the Houston Celtic Festival and Highland Games. This family-friendly event will be held at the Houston Farm and Ranch Club on Highway 6, just north of I-10. Gates open at 9 a.m. both days. Kilts optional. For details and ticket prices, check the website at HoustonHighlandGames.com. You are tuned in to 90.1, listener-sponsored and commercial-free since 1970. KPFT.org online and on Facebook at KPFT Houston.
It's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots.
You've heard of the war on drugs, and you've heard of the war on terror. But have you heard of the war on working people? Tune in on Friday nights at 8 p.m. for Houston's first and only labor radio show, Voices at Work.
We'll discuss labor issues, welcome interesting guests, and exchange ideas on what we, the workers, can do to start calling the shots. Union or non-union, we'll keep you informed of what's happening in the working environment. So join your hosts, Ron Gagne and Christine Diaz,
for your outlet to the working world.
Join us on Friday nights at 8 p.m. for Voices at Work.
This is KPFT Houston.
They can learn.